Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
One of the realities that most defines human existence is inequality. One of the most daunting challenges to any society is what to do about it. Globally today, nearly half the people in the world, about 3 billion people, scratch by on less than $2.50 a day. The United States has 5% of the world's population, but 30% of the world's wealth. Within our country, according to statistics published in Slate and the New York Times recently, the richest 1% today take home 24% of all the income. They got just 9% in 1976. CEOs made 50 times their lowest paid employee in 1982. Today, it's 531 times. From 1980 to 2005, more than four-fifths of the total increase in American incomes went to the richest 1%. Inequality among Manhattan residents alone, don't even ask. The Slate series concludes the U.S. is now a banana republic, more unequal than Nicaragua or Venezuela. And this all goes to the heart of our most pressing current policy debates. How much to take from elsewhere to give health insurance to all? How much to tax the wealthiest among us for fairness in the Great Recession versus how much those taxes would cause more unemployment among those they're intended to help? Free trade or immigration by poor people seeking work versus downward pressure on middle-class wages? Restrict greenhouse gases only among the richest, most polluting nations, or also the developing nations trying to industrialize their way out of poverty? And weren't some of the greatest crimes of the 20th century committed by Stalin, ostensibly in the name of fighting inequality? That's why socialism and redistribution of wealth are still potent political insults. Now, the lead economist at the World Bank's research division is out with a book that puts inequality in current, historic, and even literary context. It's called The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality by Branko Milanović, who is also a University of Maryland professor. Dr. Milanović, welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Is the U.S. today a banana republic, in your opinion, more unequal than Nicaragua or Venezuela? Was that a fair comparison?
No, I think it's slightly exaggerated. I think actually the numbers, of course, which you have quoted are overwhelming, and by the sheer sort of accumulation, one starts getting quite depressed. Actually, by the end of the listing, I was really fairly concerned and depressed, but it is not true that I think the U.S. is a banana republic. It is a country which, of course, has had a dramatic increase in inequality over the last 25 years, but I still believe it is not. Actually, the numbers do show that it's still not at the Latin American levels. Some of the individual states, like Texas or Tennessee, are close to the Latin American levels, but the U.S. as a whole is still less unequal.
Why is inequality increasing so much in the United States?
You know, for the United States, I think we have a pretty good picture of what happened over the last 25 years. I would say what happened, there were three things. One is that there was a technological change or such technological progress that made returns to education, skilled labor, and actually skilled labor working with very fancy capital higher. So people essentially who had high skills started earning much more than people who were less skilled. That seems it's really driven by the market, but, you know, market is not God, so obviously one can basically adjust that market-driven inequality by doing something else on the political sphere, and that's where actually nothing has been done. Rather, reduction in tax rates, reduction in estate taxes, and so on, further exacerbated this trend. And finally, I would like to say there are also two other elements, maybe slightly less important, but one is globalization, which, as we know, actually reduced the demand for U.S.-located or U.S.-born low-skilled labor by outsourcing lots of things, although people exaggerate the importance of that element. And the last element, it's very difficult to sort of put your finger on it, but it's actually a cultural change and norms change. You mentioned that before, that the ratio between a CEO and a low-paid worker was 50 to 1, and now it's 530 to 1. Mm-hmm. So that clearly had something with the changed norms in a society.
But at the same time, are we at a point of historically large middle classes nationally and globally with more comfort and less poverty than in, say, pre-industrial times or before modern democracy or modern capitalism, where the division between top and bottom may have been narrower?
Well, you know, in the past, of course, we had income levels which were much lower than they are now. So we are really now experiencing a sort of two types of developments at the same time, and it's a little bit confusing. On one hand, over the last 50 years, and even over the last quarter of a century, we have had really unprecedented growth. We have had the world economy and people in it doing reasonably well, particularly in countries like China and India that have now reemerged and regained their position that they had, you know, five centuries ago, relatively speaking to the rest of the world and to the, relatively speaking to the rich world. But then on the other hand, we more have this maybe polarization or bifurcation of people who are really doing well, people who are exceedingly rich, and they come now gradually from more countries than simply Western Europe and the United States. And on the other hand, people who have not done that well, and even some declines, as we know that in the United States, in the share of the middle class, or at least what the middle class can expect, or even to put it differently, what the middle class can expect compared to the upper classes.
Well, one question about inequality that I think relates to that, you know, is where is the bottom? If all Americans made $100,000 a year, but the top 1% makes $1 trillion, maybe we don't care about the inequality because the bottom is so high and so comfortable. Is that the relevant question?
Well, it is generally a relevant question because it is true that in very developed and rich countries in the world, absolute poverty has been eradicated. If you go to countries, particularly in countries in Western and Northern Europe, you're not going to find people who are dying from hunger or who actually don't have a place to stay or to survive over winter in Denmark or in Norway or in Sweden. So it has been eradicated, clearly. But on the other hand, it's also true, human nature being what it is, we always tend to compare our lot to the lot not only of those who are worse off, but the lot of those who are better off, and what we believe our society should guarantee us. So if we were to tell people in the 19th century, look, you will actually have all these amenities that we now have in Denmark and Norway or Sweden, they would have been very, very happy. But if you ask them today, well, they are still happy, and we know that from happiness studies, these countries, people in those countries are the happiest, but they are not uniformly happy. They also look at the other people and say, we would like a little bit more.
Branko Milanovic, lead economist at the World Bank's Research Division and professor at the University of Maryland, is the author of The Haves and the Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. If you have any thoughts or questions for him, 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692, or post to our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Where does socialism come in? You know, the Soviet Union, history's most overt attempt at revolution in the name of equality, was, I'm sure I don't have to tell you, one of history's most stunningly dreary and murderous catastrophes.
Absolutely. Actually, I have a chapter on that in my book that you mentioned, actually, the haves and the have-nots, and the question was socialism egalitarian? And the answer, with some, of course, caveats, but I probably will not have the time to go in the caveats, but basically, yes, it is true that it was egalitarian. It eliminated number of inequalities that existed before in Russia and elsewhere. But on the other hand, it had two obvious negative effects. One was that, as you mentioned, it essentially led to the murder of thousands, and even actually, if you include the famine, millions of people, mm-hmm. and which is obviously a huge crime. And the second thing, it really, by emphasizing equality, it really took away the incentive to work hard, innovate, invent new things, create new things, and then basically it failed because of these two issues, that taking away political rights and also imposing an unrealistically low income inequality.
So does that mean we can't really talk about inequality in a vacuum? We have to talk about the tension between reducing the misery and injustice of inequalities while not dragging everyone into equal dreariness?
That's exactly right. I actually believe very often mistake stems from people's misunderstanding of what really inequality means. That if people, if like me, somebody is concerned with inequality, some people would interpret to mean that essentially I would like everybody to be leveled at the same, you know, level of income. But of course, that's not true. It's not feasible. It has never existed, and it really does not yield good economic results. On the other hand, if we go at the other extreme and really have very unequal societies like in Africa and Latin America, we know that doesn't work either, because there you have entrenched elite that takes all the plum jobs for itself, does not let other people accede to higher levels of education, and that's not good for the country either. So really, it is maybe sort of a dry statement, but we have to find, and many countries maybe have found, an optimal level of inequality, which would be compatible with ability of people to accede to higher positions. So we have to distinguish inequality and social mobility.
Amy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello. Amy, are you there? Oh, let me try this again. Sorry, my fault. Amy, we got you now.
Okay, hi. Brian, near the beginning, you mentioned redistribution of wealth, and a lot of the right-wingers are railing against that in terms of, you know, mainly having to do with the question of extending the tax cuts for the highest earners.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have to wonder, where were they when the wealth was being redistributed in the other direction, when we were going from a 50-to-1% rate, a 51 ratio to a 530-to-1 ratio?
Right, and it's still happening. What do you think about some of the language of the politics of this, Branko? You know, we hear redistribution of wealth used in that way, only to refer to government policies that try to provide a safety net or whatever. You know, we had a labor union leader on the show last hour who said there's a class war in America. And, you know, he didn't mean it in the same way that Sean Hannity does.
You know, I really think, and of course that's my sort of private personal opinion, but I really think that this language has gone a little bit too far, because we have in the United States, a country which has had, you know, relatively normal levels of redistribution, and really even the word redistribution is wrongly used, in normal levels of taxation and expenditures, even low by the levels of rich developed countries. And now the language which now really sort of tarts everything by calling it redistribution, it's just gone way, I think, too far, does not reflect reality. And when people, of course, speak of taxes, they have also, I mean, they do realize, but they don't want to mention that, that taxes do not take place in a vacuum. There is actually, it is not lost money. These taxes pay for hundreds of functions of which they are beneficiaries, from health, education, Medicare, Social Security, lights in the streets, the police, and so on. So, you know, they should not forget that, but I think they oftentimes prefer to believe that, you know, all these good things can somehow exist on their own.
Roger in Asbury Park. Hi, Roger. You're on WNYC.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wonder about the moral dimension of economic inequality. I wonder why the churches are so up in arms, are so concerned about the problems of the poor and not the problems of the rich.
I think it's a very good question. Of course, churches are concerned about problems of the poor, and indeed they should be, but they are very coy, I would say, generally speaking, when it comes to huge amass of people who have really amassed enormous amount of wealth. And I think that there is a certain reluctance. I cannot really say why churches don't do that, but I know that actually among many people, there is a little bit of a reluctance to address even the issue of inequality, because it seems, you know, when I speak of poverty, I implicitly say, well, you're rich, and I really appreciate the fact that you're willing to help somebody who is poor. But when I speak of inequality, I am tacitly questioning the legitimacy of your income or wealth. And I think that actually sort of keeps some people very cautious even in mentioning the word inequality.
Because they'll mention the moral challenges of being so wealthy from the public, from the pulpit, and then they'll pass the hat, the collection plate.
And they should do that in order, of course, to help the poor. But I think that also they should, as the caller said, I think they should actually put greater emphasis on the fact that the rich, first, are not doing sufficiently. And secondly, also wonder a little bit if some of that money Think, for instance, of the money that was made on Wall Street in the last couple or 10 years, 5-10 years, if that money really was acquired in a way that is actually good for society.
Branko Milanović, author of The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. He's also chief economist for the World Bank's research division. Do you think that capitalism is inherently an inequality machine?
I think so. I think it's an inherent inequality machine. But having said that, it does not mean, as I said before, that it is necessarily a bad system. Actually, as we speak now, it's the only game in town. So that's really the system which has now been adopted by the 98% of mankind, if not more. So that's very clear. Now, there are, of course, many different variants of capitalism. Some of them are very unequal, and some of them have barely gotten out of feudal systems, if you will. And then there are others that are at the other extreme, social democratic, and they are fairly equal. So as I said to your question, yes, I would agree that's true, but maybe that's something that actually capitalism needs to do.
So do you see an inherent tension between equality and freedom? Because outspoken capitalists love to talk in terms of individual freedom.
Well, that's of course a very good question, because I think they do create a sort of a false contrast or antinomy between these two terms, because they speak of as if freedom by itself would generate incredible levels of inequality, and if freedom itself justifies such levels of inequality. And I think that's where it is a mistake, because in reality, it's really societies through the government and through participatory and representative democracies that have to actually find that optimal point between a very excessive inequality and lack of inequality, or actually some excessive equality.
Greg in Crown Heights, you're on WNYC. Hello, Greg.
Hi, Professor. Quick question. Why do you think the banana republics of Tennessee and Texas have such huge inequalities relative to the rest of the country?
Well, I think actually, I don't know actually, because I'm not expert on Texas or Tennessee. I just noticed that they do have, and I think the reason, and generally Western states have greater inequality. I think part of the reason is probably the fact that there is quite a lot of low-skilled workers, lots of migrants, and populations are in that sense much more diverse in terms of their skills and also capital assets, because if you have quite a lot of immigrants, they come with almost no capital assets, then they have acquired gradually through several generations that, but when they come in, they actually don't have very much. And that really contrasts very much with the Northeast, where you actually have much more established society and probably less heterogeneous than in Southwest.
So what do you think about some of these schemes that people come up with sometimes to say, instead of a lot of individual social welfare programs that we have, give each baby born in the United States as a birthright $80,000. You ever hear that? And so there's this kind of capital formation right from birth. It's going to grow in value as they grow up, and then they're going to be an adult. Young adult with a nest egg to start with, capital to begin using to live a life. Do you think there's anything in that, or is that just far-fetched?
Well, it's probably a little bit far-fetched, because these programs have been around. I mean, the ideas have been around for a long time, but not much has happened. However, I would not dismiss it out of hand. I think also they cannot replace the programs fully, the programs which do exist. If you look, for example, at Social Security or any state-funded pension program, that pension program is based precisely on the idea that really you are saving indirectly through state help, you're saving for old age. The problem with giving people a lump sum, large amount of money, whether it be at birth or actually later, leads to the following problem, that actually people might recklessly spend that money, and then what happens? They're back asking state for social assistance. So in that sense, I think there are certain programs which cannot be replaced by an alternative. The same is true for unemployment benefits. You're paying them when people lose jobs. You don't want to give them a lump sum in advance whether they have a job or not.
You've argued that the financial crisis that we're still suffering from was caused by historic inequality. How is that the case?
Well, I argue that, and I will make it very simple, there are basically two steps to that analysis. The first step says, and that's not controversial, the first step says we have had an increase in inequality in the United States over the last 25 years. Much more money has been accumulated in the hands of very few people. These people need ways to invest that money. So they really need a financial sector that would invest that money. Okay, that was the first step. The second step, I think, was more important. It's a political step. At the same time, median incomes have not risen. And it has become a political issue because for 20 years you have had people really at the top, you know, basically taking two-thirds or three-fourths of the total increase in income in this country. And then politically that problem was solved by essentially, you know, politicians encouraging people to borrow. Because then if you really lead a life which is way in excess of what of money that you're making, you have actually no reason to complain. Suddenly it seems things are doing well and going well for you. And then the financial sector came in there as well because it was something that actually they wanted to make money, and they started lending money to people who actually did not have means of borrowing that. And that's why I think that these two parts, the economic part, which is really excessive concentration of money, and the political part, that in a democracy you cannot have a middle class that falls behind and has really not enjoyed fruits of higher growth, led to the crisis that we are experiencing now.
So do you conclude with any major policy prescriptions?
Well, the major policy, the implication, rather, of that would be that income inequality really has to be taken seriously, which means has to be factored in and to be reduced. In some sense, I think it's already happening because the first effects of the crisis have been more severe for the rich people than for the middle class and the poor. Now, the problem is that the second-level effects, which we are experiencing now with high unemployment rate, are going really to trickle down and affect poor and the middle class. And that second-order effect really, I think, needs to be reversed by actually reemphasizing or improving or augmenting transfer programs to help the middle class.
Does that mean taxation of the wealthy or something else?
For me, it just means taxation of the wealthy. That's all.
Branko Milanović, who is the lead economist at the World Bank's Research Division. He's out with a book called The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, some follow-up Friday segments, including a mistake I made about the space shuttle program. We'll correct it. And an overlooked group of American senior citizens, not baby boomers, not people from the Depression era, but the war babies of World War II and why they are historically significant. You can call in if you're a war baby. And a call in this hour for restaurant goers in New York City. Are you paying attention to those new large type restaurant health grades displayed on the front door? Do you care when you make your restaurant decisions? We'll have a call in for restaurant goers coming up as well. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.